Chapter 8. Savimbi. I now had a good handle on Roberto and the FNLA, thought to be our chief hope in Angola, and so far the recipient of most of the CIA's largesse. To complete the picture, we needed a look at the Angolan long shot, UNITA, and its chief, Jonas Savimbi. This I set out to have on Wednesday, August 20th, 1975. It was immediately clear that UNITA was an organization of very different caliber than the FNLA. The UNITA foreign minister, Jorge Sangumba, was prompt in picking us up. Sangumba and I rode to the airport in a UNITA sedan, with my communications team following in the CIA carryall. Footnote. The two communicators did their job well and remained inconspicuous, as their role dictated. One would return to Washington and spend 3 weeks in the hospital, critically ill with falciparum malaria. End footnote. We eased through the VIP section of the regular terminal as Sangumba's aide cleared us past the immigration officials and boarded a small Lear executive jet. On the two-hour hop down to Silva Porto, the British co-pilot served coffee from a thermos. A liberation movement with its own Learjet? We understood it was the gift of a London Rhodesian investment company, which was betting on Savimbi to win the war. Special access to Angolan minerals would be prize aplenty. An ideal gift, the little jet gave Savimbi long legs across Africa. He could drop in on African leaders near and far. Jomo Kenyatta in Nairobi, Leopold Senghor in Dakar, Jules Nyerere in Dar es Salaam, while maintaining close supervision of his campaigns in central Angola. A UNITA commander was waiting for us beside the small Silva Porto terminal building, which was festooned with hundreds of political posters and painted slogans. His four-door Fiat sedan quickly carried us over the two-kilometer dirt track into town, where I was deposited in the living room of a small house. As Sangumba disappeared into the adjoining dining room, I caught sight of a stocky man in a dark green utility uniform sitting at the head of the table. His skin was very black and his beard full and shiny. His wide, prominent eyes flashed at me briefly. A few minutes later, he came through the door and introduced himself as Jonas Savimbi. "We will have time to talk, but I must first go to a meeting of the UNITA Party Congress," he said. "You are welcome to come." I followed as Savimbi strode several blocks into a crowd of over 1,000 people that closed around him, singing UNITA party songs. He mounted the steps of a public building and went inside. A few moments later, Sangumba appeared on a balcony and began calling to the crowd and beckoning. I was shoved inside, where I found an auditorium packed with 300 or more Africans. The crowd continued to chant, "Savimbi! UNITA! Angola!" As Savimbi began to speak, the assembly stilled to hear a master of a speaking style once popular in our own society, but now as rare as the deep-throated belly laugh and the barroom brawl. Savimbi's voice was rich and well-modulated. As he spoke, his whole body turned to different parts of the audience, and he leaned forward and gestured, reaching his hands to the people, then drawing them back to his chest. When he nodded, the crowd agreed. His displeasure was theirs also. Answers to his questions came thundering back in unison. UNITA, Angola, MPLA. The performance reflected his missionary upbringing. His father had been a part-time evangelical preacher. And the crowd's reaction was spiritual, more like a prayer meeting than a political gathering. According to my interpreter, he was delivering predictable cliches. UNITA is the hope for Angola. We have defeated the Portuguese. We will defeat the MPLA. UNITA will prevail. After his speech, he sat down calmly. Others rose to speak, representing different regions. This could go on all afternoon, I thought apprehensively. But after perhaps an hour, Savimbi arose, made a brief statement, and left the room, nodding to me to follow. Savimbi was all business. First, we would talk. Then we would tour the local UNITA garrisons. What was my mission, he asked, listening carefully while I told him. He had already been briefed by my colleague in Lusaka, I said, and I was here from Washington to study UNITA's strengths and catalog his needs. Savimbi then began to speak quietly, simply, in detail. troop strengths and dispositions? He unfolded a map and pointed out his principal bases and the current battles. He said he had about 300 men with him in Silvaporto. Later, I counted a total of 323 divided in two groups, one at the garrison in town, and the other in a camp a few kilometers out a rough dirt road. Then came a walking, verbal reenactment of his force's expulsion of the MPLA from Silvaporto a week earlier. My commander advanced his company across here, firing on those buildings there. We didn't have to waste much ammunition before they surrendered. No one was killed. I didn't want to fight them, but they fired on my jet before it landed. We sent 50 MPLA prisoners to Lobito on trucks. Roberto would have exaggerated and called it a major victory, and the difference would have lain not so much in subterfuge as in their relative combat experience. Since 1967, Savimbi had committed himself to the Angolan bush, personally leading the fighting and building the infrastructure of the UNITA movement. Also, sparing the lives of the 50 MPLA fighters probably reflected Savimbi's vision more than humanist sympathies. He suggested repeatedly in the next 2 days that the ultimate hope for Angola still lay at the conference table rather than on the battlefield. Savimbi's strategic objectives seemed to lie in central Angola, the Ovambundu heartland, and the Benguela Railroad. Luanda was far away and less important. We drove to the camp outside of town and found the garrison assembled in three company-sized ranks. On the way there, along the roadside, soldiers and civilians alike arose when they saw the car and ran forward, crying out, "Savimbi!" and holding up their right index fingers, the UNITA symbol for national unity. The troops were unarmed, and some of them poorly clad. "I have rifles for them," Savimbi said, sensing my question, "and they know how to shoot. But I keep the rifles locked up. Otherwise, they might be lost." I asked what he needed most. Big mortars and bazookas with a lot of ammunition. Weapons that will shoot far and make the enemy run away. My men are not afraid to fight close, but when they do, I can lose too many soldiers. I cannot afford to lose them. "And uniforms?" "Yes, uniforms," he said. "And boots." Then he reconsidered. "Later. Other things are more important. My men can fight barefooted. Without guns and ammunition, they cannot fight." We ate that night at his conference table, and then I sat in the living room and talked to two political operatives, including an earnest and attractive young woman who was a delegate from Serpa Pinto. From her comments, I was able to make a chart of the UNITA political organization, including the Congress, regional committees, and women's and youth councils. Savimbi held a meeting in the next room until about 11 p.m., when he disappeared upstairs with the girl. One of the aides escorted me to Stark guest quarters in a two-storied apartment building 3 blocks away. The night was clear and quite chilly. Silvaporto was on the same vast plateau that runs from southern Zaire through Zambia and Rhodesia. It was the dry season, the time of the year when we'd had crystal frosty mornings in Lubumbashi. Shortly after dawn, Savimbi and I flew out in a single-engine plane, so small the Portuguese pilot clucked and scowled as he calculated the fuel against our gross weight. In Kangomba, 300 kilometers east, we transferred to a late-model Land Rover and drove in swirling clouds of dust for 2 more hours toward Luso. The central Angolan highlands, though open to European exploitation later than the Bakongo and Mbandu areas, eventually succumbed to Portuguese adventurers seeking slaves and mineral wealth. The Ovimbundu tribe, which dominated the area, developed a taste for wealth and entrepreneurship, as the Portuguese subjugated them by playing tribal factions against each other. In 1902, the Bailundu king, Mutu Akwelu, led a general uprising that held out for 2 years against a Portuguese expeditionary force. Simultaneously, the Kwanhama people further south sustained a resistance for 4 years before they too were suppressed. In the mid-1950s, the Ovimbundu trailed the Mbundu and Bakongo in pre-nationalist development, not because they were less resentful of Portuguese domination, but because of their isolation in central Angola, fewer managed to obtain European educations, and it was not until 1966 that they mounted an active resistance to the Portuguese. Jonas Malheiro Savimbi was born August 3, 1934, to a prominent family of the Ovimbundu tribe at Manhango on the railroad near Luso. His father, Lot Malheiro Savimbi, was a railroad station master who had been converted to Christianity by an American evangelical mission. Lot Savimbi started and ran a grade school and church at his first small rail station, until protests by the Portuguese Catholic clergy resulted in his being transferred to another post. The local population continued, nevertheless, to support the little church, and Savimbi started another at his next post. Again he was transferred, and again. The end result was a string of schools and churches along the railroad in central Angola. Jonas Savimbi inherited his father's respect for education. He attended Protestant mission schools, including the secondary high school at Silva Porto, and eventually graduated from the Liceu at Santa Bandeira, Angola, at the top of his class. In 1958, Jonas Savimbi was one of a pioneer group sent by the United Church of Christ to study medicine in Portugal. Badgered by the Portuguese police, he left Portugal in 1960 and continued his education in Switzerland, switching from medicine to political science. In 1961, Savimbi committed himself to revolutionary activities, joining the FNLA as the GRAE foreign minister and accompanying Roberto on one visit to the United Nations. However, in 1963 to 1964, diverging interests of the Central Angolan people led him to split with the FNLA and begin organizing an Ovimbundu movement. Footnote: CIA biographic publications reflect Holden Roberto's prejudices by claiming that in 1966, Roberto sent Savimbi to Cairo to hand carry a $50,000 donation from the United Arab Republic. But Savimbi absconded with the money to Lusaka, Zambia, where he used it to start UNITA. In fact, Savimbi had broken with Roberto in 1964. End footnote. In 1967, he was expelled from Zambia after he directed attacks on the Benguela Railroad, which carried Zambia's copper to the sea. He spent 8 months in exile in Cairo before deciding to take personal command of UNITA inside Angola, first visiting the People's Republic of China to solicit support. Footnote: Markham, The Angolan Revolution, Volume 1. End footnote. The Chinese gave small amounts of material help, and the North Koreans provided guerrilla training for 12 fighters. With small numbers of men and limited means, Savimbi became a festering thorn to the Portuguese in central Angola, and a living legend among the Ovimbundu people. They used helicopters and horse-mounted troops and dogs, but they could never catch us, Savimbi recalled. They were never sure where we were. I would visit the faithful inside the cities at night. I once went right into Silva Porto and left only 15 minutes before the Portuguese raided the house. Then I would walk for 2 days and nights and show myself 100 kilometers away and do it again and again until the Portuguese and the people thought I was everywhere. I listened, fascinated. A little of that sort of action, magnified by rumor, poor communications, and natural exaggeration, transforms a man into a god in the minds of a suppressed people. I knew from experiences in the Congo that some Africans could cover phenomenal distances on foot. This man was a strapping mesomorph who would translate his ambition into physical activity. I learned when to go away, he said. I put Nzaupuna, my best man, in charge of B province, and he couldn't seem to do anything. Finally, I realized the people would never listen to him while Savimbi was there. So I went away, and 3 months later, he was one of my best commanders, and Bia was the best province. Savimbi had thus organized UNITA into 3 regions and developed reliable leaders for each one. Organization, leadership, and the courage to delegate, I thought. The CIA's managers should understudy this man. How do you communicate with your forces in Bia and on the Lobito front? I asked. I send written messages by Land Rover. It takes days, and you can never be sure the messenger will not be captured or killed. You don't know until you get an answer back 1 week, 2 weeks later. Before, we sent messages in the hands of runners on foot. A system as old as Africa itself. A wiry runner carrying a letter wedged in the end of a split stick, detouring around lion prides and elephant herds in the very old days, around Portuguese patrols in recent times, now around the MPLA. Savimbi spoke sharply to the driver, and we skidded to a stop. He got out with me close on his heels and hurried to the roadside where a small group of serious-looking soldiers rose up from ambush positions in the waist-high grass. Savimbi talked animatedly with the leader, a young man of perhaps 22. He turned to me. "This is Ilunga. He is a swimmer. He saved my life when we were crossing the Kasai, when the Portuguese were chasing us." He stood looking at Ilunga, who returned his gaze with great dignity. The bond between them was almost tangible. Savimbi broke the spell by giving instructions on how to improve the ambush, kneeling beside an anthill and looking down the road, pointing his own automatic rifle. As we drove on, Savimbi told me how Ilunga had saved him years ago. It was a harrowing tale of encirclement and flight. "We had been on the run for 10 days, he recalled, with Portuguese troops on every side and closing in. Only three of us were still alive. Ilunga ran in front, and Nzau Puna came behind. Puna was wounded and bleeding. I pictured them running along a grassy ridgeline, like the one we were driving over. Savimbi would have been leaner in tattered khaki shorts instead of his splendid green uniform. We had run almost 30 kilometers since the day before, but there was still no safety. We would have been caught but for Mama Tshila. She and her sister walked 15 miles to feed us and stood guard while we slept. When the Portuguese came, she fired her rifle the way I had taught her, so we could run away. The Portuguese had horses and dogs and an airplane. Every time we would slip away, they would find us again. They drove us into open country, and the plane watched us while a Portuguese squad chased us. Other times we could outrun the Portuguese easily, but we were already tired, and they had black scouts with them. Things did not look good. They would catch us before darkness came, and the river would not help because I did not know how to swim. We knew about Portuguese prisons if they caught us. I was not afraid to die, but I wanted to live, to free my people. I was worried about Mama Tshila, but later I learned that she pretended to be dead when they threw a grenade. The next day, Savimbi introduced me to Mama Tshila and referred to her as a revolutionary matriarch. Her face was disfigured with jagged scars. We had tried to ambush a train, but the Portuguese had spies in UNITA, and they set a trap, and our dynamite didn't work right. My 12 men had not yet come back from North Korea. The plane dived at us when we got close to the river. I shot at it, but you never seem to hurt those planes with a rifle. Nzau Puna fell down. He seemed to be finished, but I carried him to the river. I did not want them to find our bodies to drag them in the streets of Silva Porto. We threw our weapons into the water and jumped after them. The water carried us away, and Ilunga pulled me across. Our luck saved us from the Portuguese and from the crocodiles, and the Nzau Puna got well. Another time, we went back and blew up the railroad. The story was full of associations for me. I had spent part of my childhood hiking and hunting on similar hills, near the same river, the Kasai, 400 kilometers north in the Belgian Congo. In Chikala, a small town on the railroad, we stopped before a simple brick house on the only street in town. A number of somber people were gathered in front. Two were wearing blood-spattered white smocks. In the anteroom were 4 soldiers, 3 seated on a bench and the other lying on a mat on the floor. All were patched with soggy bandages. The smell of rotting blood was strong, and flies were everywhere. Savimbi spoke to them briefly, and I followed him into the next room. A young man was stretched out on a table, his chest heaving, drawing air through a huge gaping bloody hole, where an hour before he had had a nose and mouth and jaw. As we left, Savimbi said matter-of-factly, "He will die. There is nothing we can do." There was now only one doctor in all of central and eastern Angola, and little medicine. It was a brutal place for the wounds of war, the kinds that shrapnel from mortars and rockets would make. Infections were immediate, and without antibiotics, even small wounds could be fatal. We stood on the Benguela Railroad and stared down the visual infinity of rails and cross ties. I projected my mind beyond the horizon, 600 kilometers to Benguela itself, and the crystal waters of the Lobito Harbor. Turning 180 degrees, I looked 900 kilometers to Lubumbashi, and remembered the huge mines which disgorged tons of copper ore to be transported to waiting ships by an endless string of open railroad cars. Standing on the railroad tracks in the bare African veldt, I felt an almost mystical objectivity about the CIA and the things I had done. The pointlessness of my operations in Lubumbashi, the brutality and betrayals of Vietnam, the empty cynicism of the case officer's role. Savimbi was impatient to move on. For a moment I resented him, with his clear objectives and clean conscience. He was that rare coincidence of history, a throwback to the great tribal leaders of Africa, to T'Chaka Zulu, Msiri, and Jomo Kenyatta, a far cry from the conflicting values and goals of America and of the CIA in its middle-aged mediocrity. Our Land Rover left the improved dirt road and growled up a sandy track, halting in a small settlement. About 50 men were in view, most carrying weapons. We were 15 kilometers from Luso, where a bitter fight was taking place. Savimbi introduced me to a tall, lean Angolan, General Chiwale, commanding general of UNITA's armed forces. The two of them talked earnestly in Portuguese and Ovimbundu. Savimbi, knowing I did not understand, turned and explained that Chiwale was going to commit more troops to the Battle of Luso. Outside, Chiwale gave a number of loud commands. Nothing like, "Fall in A and B companies and the mortar section." He stood in the back of a truck, waving his hands and yelling, until men began milling closer with their rifles, a few individuals darting off to huts to drag out some forgotten piece of equipment. They were almost silent and looked determined. Chiwale continued at intervals to call out, until, with little more ado, they were loaded onto small trucks, jammed together until they became an indistinct mass of heads, arms, legs, and guns. The truck sagged and buckled, the springs sitting heavily on the overloaded shackles, and the tires folding over on themselves. Incredibly, the vehicles groaned forward, down a sandy track out the backside of the compound, and onto the brushy plain. Chiwale, Savimbi, and I crowded against the driver in the cab of the lead truck. After 30 minutes, we stopped a kilometer short of Luso. Most of the soldiers remained on the trucks. Savimbi and Chiwale walked a few yards to one side, to a clearing where the grass and leaves of the short trees had been burned off. Kneeling, they drew diagrams on the ground like sandlot quarterbacks mapping out plays. A half-dozen soldiers moved smartly to points a few yards out to provide security from attack, but turned inward to face Savimbi and Chiwale, instead of outward to the potential attacking enemy. Chiwale stood and ordered the rest of his troops off the trucks. Savimbi turned to me. "Now we go back." I remonstrated, wanting to see UNITA in action, but he was firm. Chiwale would run this battle. We barely had time to get safely back to Silva Porto before dark, and Savimbi was concerned the plane would leave Kangomba without us. Tomorrow he wanted to concentrate on preparations to attack Lobito. "The MPLA is no problem to us," he said, habitually pronouncing it with an extra syllable. "MPLEA." "They run away, but in Luso we are fighting the gendarmes from the Katanga. They are very strong, and they don't run away." The Katanki gendarmes, Katgens, as we call them back at headquarters, were refugees of Moise Tshombe's attempt to wrest Katanga province from Zaire in the early 60s. At President Kennedy's instigation, a United Nations force had crushed the secession, and instead of yielding to Mobutu's dominion, the secessionist army had fled into Angola, where they joined their Lunda tribal brothers and remained a menacing force of 3,000 to 4,000 men, perennially poised against Zaire's exposed underbelly. Now they were automatically opposed to Mobutu and his allies, the FNLA and UNITA, whom they would implacably challenge throughout the duration of the war. I had seen no whites with UNITA's troops anywhere. "No Portuguese," Savimbi said with the only hostility I ever saw in him. "We need help, but not from any Portuguese. My men will work with Americans or Canadians, maybe French. South Africans can help, but never Portuguese." Roberto was choking down his resentment and working with the Portuguese while the war was hot and the FNLA desperate for advisors. Savimbi was too proud to turn to the Portuguese, but otherwise he had no prejudice. And no profound ideology. He was neither Marxist nor capitalist, nor even a black revolutionary. He was an Angolan patriot, fighting for the freedom of the Ovimbundu people. He had accepted North Korean training for his men and Chinese money and arms. He liked Americans. If South Africa would give him the help he needed, he would accept. Both he and Roberto were making mistakes, but of the two, Savimbi's mistake would be more costly. Once his acceptance of South African aid became known, he would be discredited as a black nationalist. He would win a few battles, but eventually lose the war. Early the next morning, Savimbi took me to a training camp a few kilometers from Silva Porto. The commanders, who knew we were coming, had assembled the garrison in a large clearing. Three companies formed on three sides of a quadrangle, and a platoon of women in civilian dress squared the fourth. As we approached, singing and dancing women blocked our car, forcing us to walk the last 50 yards while they clapped, stamped, and swirled around Savimbi. I recalled from the Congo that such singing and rhythm were historic cultural things. In two tribes I had lived among, the Luloa and Bakete, the people moved readily into stirring chants on any occasion. When rowing a boat, returning from a successful hunt, or honoring a chief. Savimbi made another speech, then showed me his meager armory, counting weapons and giving his personal opinion of each. In the 2 days, I had counted 12 different types of shoulder weapons, including some Portuguese G3s, Belgian FNs, NATO FALs, Chinese AKs, and Soviet Kalashnikovs. They also had American bazookas, 81 and 60 millimeter mortars, hand grenades, and 106 millimeter recoilless rifles, but only a paltry number of rounds for each. There was no apparent logistical system, other than Savimbi's memory of what he had, and I shuddered to think of the confusion that would result from our delivery of tons of equipment and supplies. On the way back, I questioned him again about UNITA's troop strengths. "It is hard to be exact," he said. "We are not organized that way." Together, he and I extrapolated 4,000 UNITA troops, more or less ready for combat, plus 6,000 trainees. These were the figures I reported to headquarters. Here was the most significant finding of my trip. We had understood that UNITA was the weakest militarily of the three liberation movements. In fact, Savimbi's army was several times larger than the FNLA's, better led, and supported by a political organization of some depth. This would be heartening news at headquarters, an unexpected asset in our war against the MPLA. On the other hand, the UNITA forces, like the FNLA, had no logistical system, the poorest of internal communications, and no organization or leadership below the level of major. Savimbi deposited me at the airport, shook my hand gravely, and left. There were no parting speeches. His mind was already on the preparations for the Battle of Lobito. We were back in Kinshasa by late afternoon. I went directly to the embassy, read the cable traffic, and then went into St. Martin's office. He greeted me indifferently, and then, as though in afterthought, handed me a cable, assuming a defiant stance ready for a fight. "Here, you better read this," he said. "Oh, that." I didn't take it from his hand. "Yeah, I already saw that on your reading board outside." It was his comment on my FNLA report, bearing the Eyes Only Plotka Slug, Potts's pseudonym, for Potts's exclusive attention. Without disputing the facts, it cast a shadow on some points in my report. It was an effort to demonstrate his seniority, as basic as a dog sniffing another's urine and covering it with his own. I had so far avoided an argument with St. Martin, and meant to keep it that way. "You're entitled to your own comment," I said about his cable. "Listen, Colonel Castro is over at the Intercontinental." Castro had telephoned the embassy, requesting a meeting, and in St. Martin's own city, I was obliged to tell him of any agent meetings or covert activity. The next morning, I cleared through the station with little delay, only taking time to send out a brief message giving my estimated time of arrival in Washington. Late that night, I stood nursing a drink in a Madrid discotheque, watching young Europeans dance to the throbbing music. I had moved too quickly from Silva Porto to Madrid, from the chanting faithful of UNITA, who stamped and sang their worship of Savimbi, united in a life-and-death common cause, from the somber, scared soldiers of Luso, from the faceless, dying boy in Chicala, to the emptiness of a European nightclub. Tomorrow I would land in D.C. and face headquarters, where reality was a committee meeting, corridor politics, and the turn of a phrase on a cable.